You've entered the House of Mystery on WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Panama City, Pensacola, Florida, with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Saffon, and The Conspiracy Countdown with Dr. Joe and Stephen David Lampley's Crime Commentary.
So, guess what I heard the other night?
What's that?
It was an incredible podcast. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited, and it was hosted by Richard Syrett.
Really?
Yeah.
What can you tell me about it?
Well, you know, it's mind-blowing. It covers mysteries and little-known facts, true crime stories, just alternative history, and even the paranormal.
Sounds like they're covering everything.
They are. These guys are great. And Richard Syrett, you know, I've been on a show before. What a good interview he does.
So where do I go? Where do I find this?
Well, the best place to go is the website. It's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com.
That's what?
It's conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com.
You know what? I think I'm going to go check that out. Sounds an awful lot like another show that I know of.
Holy fruit salad.
I'm back to the House of Mystery, and I'm coming out of KKNW 1150 AM Seattle, and I'm Al Warren. Keb Thompson is on his vacation. Good time to go when it's cold. Okay, now we've been talking a lot about different specials that have been on A&E, and we've got another one coming up, very important. I think everyone should see it. And it focuses on Jonestown, and it's called Jonestown, The Woman Behind the Massacre. Now, this is primarily about the four women in Jim Jones' inner circle. Now, one was a wife, and I think the other three were mistresses. We'll find out more about that. And it will air on Monday, which is February 26th, I believe, 9 p.m., Eastern and Pacific, so check your listings for A&E to find out your time and place. So joining us to talk about this is a survivor of the Jonestown massacre, and her name is Leslie Wagner Wilson. Oh. And thank you for being on the show, Leslie.
Thank you for having me.
So Leslie, now just let's kind of run through. Now, this happened in 1978, and so that's quite a while ago, and some of the younger listeners probably won't know anything about this. I was around, I remember it, and how shocking the whole thing was, just the whole over 900 people ended up dead in this mass suicide. So, Leslie, how did it start for you? Like, how, first of all, without going into too much detail, but how did you get to be there?
Well, so again, thank you for having me. So I have to make one correction. It was a mass suicide. It was a suicide massacre, because 7 autopsies were done, and those show that there were injection marks in the shoulder blades. So I just wanted to clarify that. But I was brought into People's Temple, which was based out of California, when I arrived at the age of 13, because my sister was on heavy-duty drugs such as mescaline and acid and LSD. And this was, of course, during the Love and Peace Movement and during the late 60s. And so my mother was at wit's end. She was a business owner. And a friend of hers told her about People's Temple, who had a youth drug rehab program, and that's how we became involved.
Now, let's jump into the special. So this seems to primarily focus on the woman in his life, in his inner circle, as they call it. So who were these people we're talking about? One was his wife, Marceline. And the other ones were mistresses. How well did you know them?
I didn't know them well because they were in the hierarchy. They were young Caucasian women. Annie Moore, which was his nurse. I'm not sure if she was his lover, but she was his nurse. And then, of course, she ended up being a murderer. And then we had Carolyn Layton, her sister. And then we had a young woman by the name of Maria Casares. So these women were in their, I would say, early 20s, mid-20s. And Jim just, he was a grand manipulator, and they ended up being, again, lovers and co-conspirators, basically.
So what do you think, initially, they weren't really, there wasn't a big plan to have everybody commit suicide or to kill everybody initially when the group first went to Jonestown, if I'm correct on that.
Well, you're correct, because no one went to Jonestown to die. I lost my entire family. People went to Jonestown to build a community that was interracially, you know, with harmony, and our children were allowed to play freely without the concerns of gunfire or racism or discrimination, basically. That's why people left the states. They wanted to prove to the world, or be an example, that there can be a community that is self-sufficient and can live in harmony. Unfortunately, that's not, of course, how it ended, but no one went to Jonestown to die, not one person.
So as a 13-year-old, you must have really, really loved it when you first got there.
Well, I loved it because I was in the States, and what impressed me was the fact that I came from very adaptable household. My mother always took in people. She had a care home which had strangers that became part of the family that were mentally ill. And so I came from a family that was giving. I came from a family that was inclusive. And so when I first walked into People's Temple at the age of 13, I was excited. I was excited to know, because I came from an upper middle class family, I didn't know that people went to bed hungry. I didn't know that people suffered because it wasn't, that's not my experience. And so once learning this consciousness and this, you know, consciousness of the world and its suffering, I felt proud to be able to be a part of this. At 13, I felt proud.
Well, what's the biggest thing you can say that how this experience has changed you?
Oh, my goodness. It has, it was tough, of course, because I suffered from, you know, I lost my entire family. I escaped the morning of the massacre with the intent of coming back with my father to get my brother and my sister if they wanted to leave. And, of course, that's not what happened. So on the good side, the positive aspects of what I learned was a sense of compassion for people that are in need, right, that are suffering. I learned that we're all connected, right, and that really love is what binds us and keeps us level and peaceful. But on the other hand, I suffered greatly, as most survivors did. We, you know, PTSD, survivor's guilt, you know, I got into drugs, I was an escape. So life was really tough the first, I would say, almost 20 years. I was functional, but I was hurting inside because the pain was just too great. But I learned now, you know, after the healing, I actually just got back from Jonestown 2 weeks ago and went back to Guyana after almost 40 years. And with that experience came a new peace. I was able to say goodbye to my family. And I have learned that we have to go within so we don't go without. That it's fine to be a believer in anything that's good, but we just have to be careful. We have to watch our steps, and we have to make sure that we're not in an isolated situation where someone's trying to control us and manipulate us. And that's basically what happened with these three young women. Marsha, of course, they were manipulated, and then they became victims, and then they became the victimizers. So they began to victimize people. It was kind of, you know, it was a circle. But I've learned to be grateful, and I've learned to continue to be able to love, right, and to try to give back as much as I can.
So how many survivors came out of the Jonestown?
That's a very good question. There were a total of 30. Our group contained 11 survivors that walked through the jungle 30-something miles to the next town. And then the other portion of those survivors left with Congressman Ryan. And one of the survivors was killed on the airstrip, Patricia Parks. So it was around 31 people that actually walked out of Jonestown that day and survived.
So, you know, you're part of the group that walked to another town. So did you know what was going to happen? And I don't mean that like, you know, there must have been a reason you guys decided to leave.
Well, there was. And I was, at that point, 20. I was working in the medical field with a doctor, Larry Schatz. I was supposed to be sent to Cuba to become a doctor. And I began to witness things that, to me, weren't correct. There were those that were dedicated and considered some of the hierarchy that received health care. They even received trips to the capital to get to receive medical care. There were those that were potential flight risk who did not get care. And I mean people that, you know, had lupus. And so I saw that discrepancy, and I thought, wait a minute, this isn't socialism. And then it became, you know, it was, Jim became more and more erratic, more and more paranoid. The community was a community that was being worked 10-hour days, 6 days a week, no food, no nutritional food. Rice and gravy was the staple. Exhausted, mentally and spiritually, just exhausted. And so it wasn't the happy place that I first got to. Jim was paranoid, you know, there was a custody battle going on, which helped participate in this whole, you know, entire event. And so I just wanted to leave. I wanted to get my child out because there was no talk of the future. And so on one hand, we did have a couple of suicide trails, right?
Yeah.
Revolutionary suicides, what Jim called them. But I never thought that we would die by our own hand. And remember that we were isolated. So everything that was given to us was given, it was given to us from them. So we really never had a clue what was actually happening on the outside. So Jim said we were under attack. We believed we were under attack. But I just saw this community change, and I didn't want to be there any longer. I didn't want my son to grow up there because, again, there was no talk of the future.
You know, I have to wonder. So there was a point where you started to feel it was different.
Oh, yeah.
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 And what do you think? So, you know, Jim Jones, you say, started to become, like, paranoid and had different... he started to change. Do you attribute anything in particular to that, or is it just something that evolved?
Well, now that, you know, coming back home and years of research and exposure, things that are finally coming out, information that's finally being released and people talking, Jim was on drugs in the United States. The majority of the congregation did not know this. He was already sadistic in the United States, right?
Yeah.
But in Jonestown, he was completely isolated. And because he ran after the article from the New West magazine was going to come out, which ex-members went and exposed some of the abuse that was going on. He became a prisoner in Jonestown. So Jim never, I don't believe he ever intended on making Jonestown his permanent home. So here's a man that's in San Francisco at the height of so much change, right? Social, political change in San Francisco. He's part of the housing commission. He's, you know, being wined and dined by politicians. Everybody adores him. He's being, you know, his ego is being fulfilled. And then all of a sudden he ends up in the jungle and it's just us. There's no lights. There's no camera. There's no spotlight on him. And his drug use, as I was to find out later, years later, was to the point to where when he was slurring his words, he wasn't sick. He was under the influence. But again, the membership didn't know this. The community didn't know this. Only those that were close to him knew that he was abusing drugs. And
yeah.
So we're just sitting ducks there.
Yeah. Well, and I guess you weren't thinking that was going to happen. Now, you said you walked to another town with others. So did you guys not, you weren't able to just ask to leave, or you had to actually,
oh, no.
You had to, I'm just trying to catch the feeling of it. Like, so.
No. Right.
Yeah.
So we were prisoners, basically. The camp was in the middle of the jungle. The closest Georgetown, the capital, was an hour by air, right, but you had to have a plane, and 24 hours by boat. We were up against the Venezuela border. There was a territorial dispute, and that's why they chose that land, because Venezuela would never come in on United States citizens. And so, but we were totally isolated. So when we got there, they took our passports. So and once you went into Jonestown, you really didn't go out. So you didn't know what was out there. Jim told us that if anyone tried to leave or escaped, that the Guyanese government, you know, was on watch for us. They would arrest us. They would, we would be under arrest. And all these lies that we thought were true, because why would we not think they were true? We didn't know anything else of what we were being told. So no, there was no way to, us leaving. And when we walked to this next town, we had no idea what we were going to face. We didn't know if they were friend or foe, because, again, we hadn't been out. We weren't exposed to the outside. We were actually prisoners inside of, you know, Jonestown. No one could just ask to leave and be able to leave. That was out of the question.
Wow. And so did you know that there was going to be, well, I guess you wouldn't, but when they were kind of, you know, there was that congressman there and all of that activity just before the end. Did you see any of that, or did you think that was going well?
Well, you know, we had planned. We had our leader of the group. His name was Richard Clark, and my friend who allowed me voted me to go. Her name was Diane Louie. So the night when the congressman came on the 17th of November, 1978, I was optimistic to a certain degree. It looked as if it was going well. We did the whole entertainment that we do for guests. You know, we actually had a good dinner, which we rarely had. And so it looked like it was going well until we heard that someone passed a note to one of the reporters saying they wanted to leave. Not only did we know that someone passed a note, but we knew who it was. And that created some tension already in the air because we're like, oh, my gosh, it's starting, right? And we were going to leave that night, but because of that note, Richard said we're going to leave the next day. So it looked like it was going well, but we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. We only saw what was presented to us in the front, right?
Yeah.
And even on Saturday, when we decided to leave, the tension in the community was just—you could just cut it with a knife. It was almost—it was so quiet, you know. It was just really quiet, and there was something in the air. I couldn't put my finger on it. And later on, I would know that it was, you know, Jim had other plans.
Yeah, and he must have had this sort of planned for a little bit of time, right? It wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
You're right, because there was cyanide found on the, there was cyanide found that came in months later, months earlier. They were already testing on a pig, I think, to see what the dosage would be. So this was actually something that was, you know, it sounds, was going to be put in place. To what degree, we don't, you know, we still don't know as if this just actually just, you know, quickened the plan or was it planned for this time, you know, if anyone came in like this, because we're just not sure. But I think that, you know, I didn't see it coming from us, even though we had the test. And I wonder, there's time, because I lost my entire family, I wonder, at times, did people think it was a test first because we had them before and they were fake? You know, they weren't real, so maybe they thought that.
Right.
And also the fact that they were exhausted, you know. But I know that people, I don't believe that, well, children don't commit suicide. You know, there's over 300 children that died. But I just think that... there's a lot more to the story. I hope we find out before I leave this world. But it was a horrific, you know, terrible incident. It was the largest loss of life before 9/11 of civilians. The majority of the people were Black women. Those were the women that propelled the finances, right? And we do have a new website called blackjonestown.org. It talks about, we're dissecting this, how do Black women, my mother was an intelligent business owner, we didn't grow up poor. How did she, you know, what caused her to join and what caused her to stay, you see?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a tragedy. We're going on, you know, this November will be 40 years. And you're right, you know, but what I have seen is I get many requests from students that are doing Jonestown History Project. So this conversation, this dialogue is important. A&E, you know, this is important because kids that weren't even born are interested, right?
Yeah.
And shows like yours. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. We do a lot of these things that happened in the 60s and 70s and, we have so many people that are young that are 20 and under. They have no idea.
Right.
It's just crazy. What do you think the biggest thing is coming out of this 2-hour special? What's the most important thing people can get from it?
For me, you know, I want to dispel the myth that there was a lot of crazy black folks that just ran to the jail and killed themselves, right? That was a stigma that I came back to. I'm African American. So I want to dispel the myth that, and I also want the viewers to look to see that even though Jim Jones preached equality, correct? That was not the case in People's Temple. The majority of the leadership was Caucasian. We look at these four women. Marsden was abused, of course. But I want them to see another side of this. So they could say, okay, well, look who was behind the scenes that we didn't know about, right? That's never been highlighted. Here are these young women. And it's a call to women, too, to say, you have to be careful. They were young, and they were very easily manipulated. And they, again, became the victims. So it's a different dialogue. I've done plenty of documentaries. I've always mentioned this conversation. Let's talk about the four women, the three women. And so A&E has had the wherewithal to pick it up and do it. So I think it's going to be a great I think it'll really be a good show, and it'll give the viewers something else, another dialogue, another conversation.
Well, when we talk about these four women, now, what's your feeling on them? Like, do you look at them as evil and bad, or do you look at them as complete victims, like they were brainwashed? Like, where do you put them in this field?
Well, it's both, actually. I believe that they were young, and Jim was very charismatic, right?
Right.
Where else do you find women can fly all over the world and deposit millions of dollars in the bank and have access?
Oh, yeah.
What organization do you know? You see, so there's this path. So he fed to their egos. He fed to their need for, I don't know if it's a father figure, attention, not sure. Because I didn't have that close relationship with them. But they became victims because he manipulated them. And then, as with Jim, power, right, can leave a lot. Some good, some bad. So I don't look at them as evil. I look at them as active participants and planners of this because they were so loyal to him that they went ahead and proceeded, even though he was not in the mental or physical condition to carry this through himself. This did not have to go as far as it did. They could have stopped this, but they, because of their loyalty to him, they went ahead and proceeded with it. Jim did not mix the poison. Jim was from, you know, even the night before, you can see some of the videotapes of that day. He was slurring his words. He looked like he was under the influence of something. He was in no condition to make a decision, but because they were, yes, brainwashed, right?
Yeah.
Because we cannot forget this was a cult. Some people don't like the word. It was a cult. People were controlled. That they took the entire distance of carrying out his wishes. I don't hate them.
No.
Listen, I had to forgive Jim Jones, right? That was the beginning of my healing, was to forgive Jim Jones. I've forgiven them in the same way that I've forgiven Jim Jones and the other active participants who we do not know. Larry Schaff was one of them, the doctor. So I've had to forgive them because I have to let go in order to be able to heal, right, to get through that.
Right. Yeah, you have to move on. And I just wonder, but, you know, this whole Jonestown scenario and the four women and other people that might have been involved that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that us as a human nature has changed because of this? Have we learned from this, is my point. Like, could this happen now?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of think it could.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about
I
you.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right, because look at the climate that we're in.
Yeah.
You see, Jim Jones came at a time where, again, there were social political changes. We were in a whole different world, right? A whole different. Oh my gosh! And I was only 13. I was marching in peace marches before I went to People's Temple, and so we're in this. We're so divided, and we're disconnected. So. Could it happen again? Unfortunately, I believe so. We have churches that are running off the same type of control, mainstream churches. I get calls and letters, emails about mainstream churches that are cult-like. And so we have to be careful. But can it happen again? Unfortunately, I can't say no that it couldn't. I just think when people feel threatened and they feel lost and they're confused and normal things are slipping away from them I just think it's a possibility. I think you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I see it a lot. I see a lot of people that get like you said, there's a lot of division. People select their enemies as people they don't understand or know.
You're right.
And it's
but it's so important if people see something to say something. You know, if you have a friend that you see the changes and they're in a group, I don't care if it's, I've been in network marketing and I found myself thinking, goodness gracious, I'm going off the deep end here a little bit, right, with my enthusiasm. So you have to be careful, and that's peer pressure, too. There were things that I saw early on as a kid, 15, 16, I wondered about, but when I looked at everyone else, the adults, and they're clapping, they're singing, they're happy, they don't say a word about what I just heard that bothered me. So then I think, well, guess what? It must be me. It's got to be just me. So
there's something about a group or mob mentality, I guess, that... everyone gets involved. It's how were the people to you when you came back to the States? How did you find the reception? Were people mean, or were they just wanted to stay away from you? What was the reaction to where you went?
I didn't give them opportunity because I changed my name and I went underground. I might have been on one. I wasn't even on the television show. I just went underground. But I know from what I read in the newspapers, I felt my goodness, look how they're looking at us, right? So that was a secret for me for almost 20 years. When I wrote the book, I had to email my friends because I didn't know who I told and who I didn't. It was that, I died. My family died in a car accident. One of my bosses said, gosh, I thought you were grew up as an orphan or in foster care because you never spoke about your family. So the stigma was there, though. People said, why are all these people following this, white man in the jungle? And my dad was, Caucasian.
Yeah.
So I didn't grow up with color. So for me, he wasn't any different than my dad, right? But... there was a stigma, and it's still, I would say, probably the last, 20 years, it's changing, the conversation's changing. People have more empathy, and I think they could see that, gosh, that could have been me. Maybe I would have joined this, But they weren't very kind. They weren't
there's a general concept that same as people like get involved in crime and different things, and they say, well, I wouldn't have never done that, or they never, so there's it's kind of a judgment call people make,
right.
And it's kind of silly in a way, because I guess it's a defense mechanism. They don't realize that we're just humans and we're all subject to things that happen, so crazy. Well, it sounds like it sounds like it's better now for you, like to be out, but I couldn't imagine. You had to keep it a secret, so you had to create a whole kind of false life to present to people.
Yes. But on the inside, it was horrible because I was hurting. And then no one said, I didn't get any counseling, right? So I'm left to my own devices to try to work through this tragedy, not understanding it. So it took me a long time to understand it. What I had to do was I couldn't go to churches. I tried. It was very difficult. So I just had to develop this personal relationship right, because I am a believer,
right,
with God. And I had to do it on my own and get through it. And so the healing, my healing really didn't start until 2007. It wasn't that long ago. I was functional, barely, right? Yeah. I was functional, but I hit it well. And I think, you know, I think I tell people I should have won an Oscar in Jonestown because I was constantly thinking about leaving. You know, you had to put on this facade that everything was okay. So it was difficult. And that's why I tell people, you know, when you have tragedy, you have to talk about it. You have to talk. Even if it's talking out loud, you have to speak of it, right? You have to speak on it because it will tear you apart inside because you're not healing.
Yeah.
You know, and you miss out so much when you don't follow that process. But you have to have a great support system too. And my grandparents just weren't cut out for that.
Well, and I was going to say that would be a terrible burden to live with and not be able to talk about it to get through it. So you're kind of put yourself right on hold for 20 years while you're mm-hmm. living a different life. And mm-hmm. you can't let go when it's still in your mind, you know. I just,
mm-hmm.
and especially when you're young, you know, 13, 20, it's
right.
so young to deal with that.
Right.
Amazing.
Right.
I tell you, it's what you've been through. Well, I guess it's made you a very strong and good soul now. You know, it's kind of, it comes out in a way, but you know, at this point in your life. But wow, I couldn't imagine. You know, I think it's amazing what you've been through, and I just I don't know what I would have done, but. Wow. So now you have a book as well, which you were mentioning. Let's give out your website and where people can look you up or maybe communicate and pick up your book, as well as the show coming out. Where do they get you?
So they can go to www.LeslieWagner.com. That's my webpage. You can order the book. Slavery, it's Slavery, S-L-A-V-E-R-Y, of Faith, on Amazon is probably the most, you know, pretty much anywhere else, but Amazon is where it's kind of housed. And you can email me if you want to have a conversation. I do speak to people that reach out about whatever they want to talk about. You know, I've been through homelessness and drug addiction and you name it, I think. So I have a lot of experience in a lot of different areas, and I'm just, I'm here to serve. That's what I've discovered. I'm here to serve. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm glad it's, I don't want to say turned out great, but I'm glad it's at least, you seem to be resolved of a lot of the early stuff. So that's amazing. So the show, it's on A&E on Monday, and that's the 26th, and it's at 9 p.m. Pacific or Eastern, and of course, check your local listings of how you get A&E, and it's called Jonestown, The Woman Behind the Massacre, and our guest has been Leslie Wagner-Wilson. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now it's time for Dr. Joe's Conspiracy Countdown of the Week.
The Pope is a lizard, and so is the Queen, who murdered Diana and got away clean. Obama's a Kenyan, and Reagan caused AIDS. George Bush had abortions, or so people say. They knocked Norma Jean off, they killed JFK, who got shot and poisoned by the CIA. They fake the moon landing. thought Roswell was real. There's drugs in the water and bugs in our meals. They can't hide the chemtrails. We can't trust vaccines. We all know that jet fuel can melt through steel beams. And the new world order will brainwash your kids and use MK Ultra to hide what they did.
Okay, every time you hear the conspiracy song, it's written by Tim Ireland, and it's part of the Campfire Songs collection. You can find it on our website. You know it's time for our conspiracy countdown. And joining us now is Dr. Joe. This is for the week of February 12th, 2018. How you doing, Joe?
Very good. Great to be with you again, as always.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure having you. It's always good talking to you. So, you've got the conspiracies for the week.
Yeah, I have a top three, but before I got into the countdown, I've been getting a lot of emails lately from listeners asking, how do you come up with the top three? How do you know what the big three are each week? So I just wanted to take a quick minute and say how I tabulate them.
Okay.
So people don't think I'm making it up as part of some conspiracy.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So basically what I do is every night I run what's called a scrape of the internet. So I pick up everything that has a handful of search terms in it. So I'm looking for conspiracy theory, birther, truther, and then a few other terms just for fun, like Bigfoot, aliens, Loch Ness Monster, and whatnot. And what I do before I come on with you every week is I tabulate all of those scrapes and find out what the big ideas are each week. And then one thing I do is that I remove the ones that are just sort of there all the time. So, you know, if I did a very true top three each week, it would be something to do with Trump and Russia all the time.
Yeah.
and just for radio's sake, that would get a little bit boring. So I pull out some of the ones that we talk about a little bit too much to try and get to the ones that maybe people aren't hearing quite as much about but are still prominent in our internet discussions.
Excellent. It's the way we want it. And you know, and actually, I bet you I can guess one of the top three.
Well, do you want to make the guess now, or if you don't tell us till the end, then I guess you could lie and say you were right.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy. No, actually, I'm just out of the blue because I saw this, and I don't know, maybe it didn't make the top three, that the Planet X and Elon Musk, the whole thing was just fake.
Okay, well, I was leaving Planet X out just because we've talked about Planet X so many times before, but they're one of the big ones this week, and it didn't make the top three, but was Elon Musk and his car that he launched into outer space.
Yeah, was that was just fake, right?
Well, they're saying it's real, but the reason it pops up is because the flat earthers are very upset with Elon Musk now because they're saying he's now part of the conspiracy to conceal flat Earth.
Well, there we go. I knew it. I knew he was evil.
I mean, if you see the pictures of the car driving through space, in the background you see planet Earth, and it looks round. And you know, globular. So the flat earthers, have accused Elon Musk of, you know, being a part of NASA's ploy or having fallen for it.
Mm, yeah, that's what I think. Okay, well, let's get on. Number three.
So number three sort of dovetails right off of that, and that is that flat Earth. Still big in the news, and this week it's big not so much because they have a new idea or new piece of evidence, but because, again, they're failing at trying to produce evidence, Mike Hughes, who is a prominent flat earther, tried to launch himself up into outer space in a homemade rocket in order to take pictures and prove that the Earth is indeed flat. But unfortunately, and you can read this in the news, his rocket has again failed to launch. So he keeps not being able to jettison himself into space to take these pictures.
Yeah. We've asked him to be on the show, but he's shying away from media. So.
Well, I think there's an obvious question here, and one is, you know, he could probably just put an iPhone on a balloon and get the same effect without a rocket.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would work. But, well, plus, how is he going to land?
Like, I guess that's another problem. Well, but assuming he's wearing a parachute, I mean.
Yeah, because I would think that was a problem.
Well, if he hasn't thought it through that far, then perhaps not being able to take off is a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, it's meant to be. Yeah, it's craziness.
Okay, so leaving geography behind, number two is Adele and Sam Smith are indeed the same person. And the singer Sam Smith is actually Adele in drag. Or vice versa.
Yeah, which one is it? Is she really she or he?
Like, so the evidence here is pretty clear, and you could find it on Twitter, and that is someone has taken recordings of Adele, slowed them down, and what you hear sounds almost exactly like Sam Smith's voice. So what they're saying is it's because of this, it's the same person.
Wow. And do we know why?
Well, I don't know if there's a clear motive, because if you're either one, you should be happy enough with just that, right?
Yeah. Okay, well, I just was trying to figure out why you would want to be an alter image and making money both ways. But hey.
Well, this goes back. There's a long line of thought involved here, and that is rich celebrities often do weird things, like fake their deaths, have body doubles, come back to life mysteriously, put out albums after they've been in the grave forever. So this is nothing different here. And if you remember, if our audience remembers last week, our countdown involved Tom Brady being a body double for Melania Trump. So apparently everybody is sort of in drag and shape-shifting.
Well, when in doubt, change your outfit.
Yeah.
Oh, the world. Wow. That's something to think about.
So our number one, so last week's number one focused, I think, on the Super Bowl. This week's number one focuses on our current sporting event, and that is the Winter Olympics in Korea. And the number one conspiracy theory this week, making the rounds, is that the ice has been sabotaged or cursed to make all of the skaters fall mysteriously.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, now, is that all the skaters, or is that just going to be American skaters? Or Korean?
Well, obviously, some American fans were upset when the American skater fell down the other evening and didn't do very well. But they've actually had an inordinate number of people falling on their jumps, and I think they've had more than five falls now. So they're saying that there's potentially something wrong with the ice.
Do you think Tonya Harding is there?
She didn't come to mind, but, you know, she has been in the news lately because of I think the movie about her.
Yeah.
My thoughts immediately went to North Korea, so.
Well, yeah, of course. They want it to fail.
So, that's our top three for the week. I'm sure as the Olympics carry on and more athletes have accidents, there'll probably be more conspiracy theories to explain that.
Yeah. You know, does anybody know where Hillary Clinton is?
No.
Maybe she's there. You know, that
maybe
would
be, she's competing.
Yeah, I'm going to write this one. I'm going to get this on the internet. Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, always to have you here talking about this. So thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, Stephen David Lampley delivers his true crime commentary.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello and welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. And I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome. Hey, I wanted to take a minute here at the onset to tell you about a book I have coming out March 31st of this year. It's the Dahmer Book. It'll be available for pre-order, and that'll be available on the website, www.thedahmerbook.com. You'll probably want to get a copy of Inside the Mind of a Serial Killer first. You can get that book on www.amazon.com/author/Stephen Lampley. Inside the Mind of a Serial Killer will give you sort of a basis of understanding about a serial killer prior to reading the Dahmer book. So this might be something you want to pick up first. All right, let's get started. Today... Now, if you have a weak stomach and you're eating, I mean a really weak stomach, we're not going to get all gross on this, okay? But if you have a semi-weak stomach and things sometimes, you know, make your stomach queasy, some subject matters, you might want to put your hot dog down or your burrito or your hamburger or lasagna, whatever it is, momentarily as you're listening to this, because we're going to talk about human decomposition. We're going to discuss some things that... If you have a weak stomach, it may not set well with you, and I certainly don't want you to lose your appetite. All right, human decomposition, particularly the compounds and the smells of human decomposition, is what we're going to go over very briefly on this segment. Now, at a fairly predictable time in the human decomposition process, the human body will begin to produce gases and chemical compounds. The human body will produce such things as cadaverine and putrescine. Now these two, cadaverine and putrescine, will give off that typical landmark rotting flesh smell. And if you've never smelled that, it's one of a kind, okay? It's a one of a kind smell. Then the next gas that the human body will give off is something called scatol. Now, it's a strong feces odor, and at the end of this commentary, I want to tell you something pretty interesting about this compound that you probably are not aware of, that you probably do not know, so stay tuned as I tell you about that. Another product is dimethyl sulfide and trisulfide. Now, this produces a foul-smelling odor similar to garlic. It's a garlicky type smell. Indole produces a mothball type smell. Now understand, body's producing all these gases and producing all these smells. So you wonder why a dead animal or a dead human stinks so badly. It's because all these smells are being produced at the same time. And it's really, like I said, a one-of-a-kind smell. You'll never forget it. And the times that I have been involved in deaths or homicides where the body has been there hours or several days, when you go into the structure, or into the building, or into the room where they are, if you stay any length of time, let me tell you something, that smell stays in your clothing. When you leave there, you will continue, it's a very pungent smell, you won't forget it. All right, and another byproduct of the decomposition of a human is a methane smell, and it has a rotting cabbage odor to it. And then, of course, now we also have hydrogen sulfide, and as the name implies, it's a sulfur smell, a rotting egg smell. Now you have all these smells coming out. No wonder it stinks, right? These odors begin to be produced during the second stage of decomposition, and that's typically when you smell these odors, and that's called the bloat phase. One of the common questions is, well, how long does it take a human body to begin to smell? Well, that depends. A cadaver dog can smell a human body almost immediately after death, almost immediately after a person dies. So it depends on how long it takes you to smell your olfactory capabilities. And it also depends on the amount of smell being produced by the human body. Now, what is it that impacts how long it takes a human body to smell? Well, there's several factors. Humidity, temperature, the age of the individual, the gender, how much sun. Typically, though, under normal conditions, outside, just general normal conditions, no extremes, you're looking at 24 to 36 hours. But again, that's not certain. It could be as few as 8 to 12 hours. It really just depends on all those factors, and actually even others that we didn't discuss. All right, now I wanted to tell you something about Scatol that you probably do not know. Now, Scatol is produced, and it has a produced by the human body, and it has a fecal, very, very pungent fecal smell to it. Now, it's also produced commercially. Now, companies actually produce this chemical. What do they use it for? Who in the world could ever want a chemical that smells like human feces? Well, let me tell you something. Scatol, when it is very, very diluted, has a flowery smell to it. Now, some of you probably see where I'm going with this already. It is used in a lot of perfumes. I know, right? Scatol is produced commercially and is used in a lot of fixatives and a lot of perfumes. I know. Listen, I want to thank you for joining me on this episode. I look forward to seeing you again next time, and have a great evening.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.